This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
This episode of Nine Lives with Dr. Cat is brought to you by Meow Greens. Get a free Jumpstart trial bag for your cat today. Go to meowgreens.com and use promo code 9LIVES.
Hey there, cat lovers. Welcome to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat. I'm your host, Dr. Catherine Prim, and I'm a small animal veterinarian and crazy cat lover. So as you guys know, I like to use this show to dive into all things feline to help your cats live their best, happiest, and healthiest life. So today, we're tackling cat skin. I have a veterinary dermatologist, Dr. Joya Griffin, with me, and we are going to dig into everything cat skin. So we'll be right back.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat on Pet Life Radio. As I mentioned, I have Dr. Joya Griffin with me today. Hi, Dr. Joya.
Hi. I'm excited to be here. We're talking about one of my favorite things as well.
Yes. Well, sometimes it's one of my favorite things and sometimes it's not. And that's why.
That is true. That is true.
And it's so important that cats feel comfortable in their skin. So I think that skin is such an overall important part of overall health. And I bet you agree.
I do agree.
So I kind of wanted to kind of talk with you because sometimes it's sort of tricky. So what are some of the most common dermatologic issues that you see in your practice?
Oh, by far the most common reason the cat will come into me is for itchy skin, recurrent skin lesions that are likely related to some allergic process. And then I think secondary to that, occasionally we'll see ear disease, like things like polyps or tumors in the ear. And then we see some autoimmune diseases as well that will affect the skin or the claws or foot pads. So it's kind of a nice smattering. I mean, I agree with you. The skin can really show a lot of disease processes. And so when we start seeing that the skin is not healthy, even if it's as mild as scaling, or when they start to develop non-healing wounds, usually there's something that's driving that, you know. So it's what lies beneath is kind of what I try to investigate. And it's really fun and very varied from patient to patient. And cats are unique because they present with skin disease a lot differently than dogs do. And we have less knowledge about their skin disease and what causes it and less medications to treat. So I've always find it a interesting challenge to try to figure out what's going on with these cats and to get them the proper care that they need.
I agree. Cats are just not dogs.
They are not dogs.
So you mentioned allergies. So can we start with allergies? Let me just tell you, in my exam room, everybody seems to think that any issue with their cat's skin is related to the cat's food. What do you have to say about that?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's a lot of messaging, I think, to pet parents that it's food allergy, food allergy, food allergy. And there are a percentage of cats that present with itchy skin, over-grooming, recurrent skin lesions that are food allergic, but it's not the only thing. You know, it can be related to flea allergy. It could also be related to environmental allergies. And in cats, they have these reaction patterns that they present with. So they're not going to be like the dog that just comes in scratching, chewing, and biting. They don't always present like that. They may present with eosinophilic granulomas or plaques, indolent ulcers, which I know you see. They may present with these little crusted papules that are called miliary dermatitis. So they have these reaction patterns when they have allergic skin disease that are very different from dogs and much less recognized in dogs. And some of the reaction patterns don't even occur in dogs. So a lot of times, because it looks so different, I think people don't know how to diagnose it. They don't know what to do. It can look scary. Sometimes the lesions look like cancerous lesions, or they look more autoimmune. And so it can get very confusing. And I sometimes see that these cases are biopsied, which I never think is wrong. I think when in doubt, biopsy it, you know, so you can get the most information. But cats are tricky. They're very tricky.
How much of diagnosing a cat with skin disease depends on finding out everything about the history?
Yes. History is really important. It's history. I mean, history is a kind of like the foundation of dermatology, I think, because the derm history really allows us to start to formulate a differential list and then to prioritize our diagnostics and what's most important for that individual cat. And so I spend a lot of time discussing the history. How did the lesions present? Was the cat exhibiting any pruritus, any over-grooming before the lesions, or did the lesions occur spontaneously? Was there a seasonality? We also always, you know, try to figure out, you know, does this cat spend time outdoors? Does it have, you know, another cat in the household that has similar lesions? You know, those kinds of things that we asked for other processes and diseases that are going on. But for derm, I think it's so important because it can really help you go in one direction or the other. I had a case that came in a couple months ago, right before the holidays, and it had been told that it had allergies over and over again. And the cat was pruritic, but the skin lesions and the pattern of hair loss was completely different than what I typically see with allergies. And as soon as I saw the cat, I said, this is not allergic disease. But we had to talk through the history and we ended up ultimately biopsying that cat. But I think sometimes too, because allergies are so common in cats and dogs, we instantly jump to that. So there are a lot of patterns with how skin lesions present that will also help us try to narrow down, you know, our differentials in which direction we're going to go.
I agree. You mentioned ulcers and eosinophilic plaques. Those things are really scary looking to pet owners. For my listeners that don't necessarily know what she means, those are like huge ulcerated lesions, and they can occur on a cat's lip. And I mean, it's very scary. If you see an erosion on your cat's lip, you need to go to the veterinarian for certain. And I think anybody listening would agree that it's something they would call the vet about.
Absolutely. I mean, they do look very scary and they can mimic cancer, you know, so it's really important to have them evaluated, treated, and then to look for a pattern. If they start to recur, if it goes away, great. That's unlikely to be cancer. But if they're recurrent or progressive, I mean, there are cases that even I will biopsy to make sure that, you know, this is not cancer and that it's more of an inflammatory process. There's nothing worse than, you know, missing the true diagnosis on something. And in the beginning, especially in cats, their lesions can look like a lot of different things. And so it can be really confusing. You mentioned diet trials and food allergy. Getting a clear-cut history helps to determine whether or not we need to move forward with those. If it's a cat that's more seasonal, I don't always do diet trials. You know, if this cat only erupts with the lesions in the summer, goes completely away in the winter, then that's very unlikely to be food with that pattern. But if it's a cat that has year-round issues, then yeah, diet trial is at the top of the list of rule outs. I have found doing diagnostic diet trials in cats to be a little trickier than dogs, just because cats sometimes can be finicky and they often live with other cats. And so it can be hard to, you know, separate the cats at feeding times. We often have to put everybody on the prescription diet, which can be very expensive. And, you know, there's a lot of limitations. And sometimes we just have cats that will not accept the diets that we want to feed them for these prescription diet trials. So it can be quite challenging.
So I think I say a lot in my exam room, cats do not have an easy button. Nothing is easy. So I had a client tell me just this week in the exam room that she had submitted some sort of panel for food allergy on her dog, actually. And so there are lots of things kind of swirling around out there that people can do at home and are doing. Can you kind of touch on that?
Yeah. Unfortunately, food testing, whether it's a saliva, a hair, or a blood test, has been found to be very inaccurate. And at this point, we just don't have the technology to accurately diagnose food hypersensitivity in cat or dogs. So I don't recommend it. I think it can be a waste of money. And sometimes it creates, you know, misinformation where the pet parent is really stuck on what this piece of paper says and they're trying to avoid all of these things in their cat's food and the cat's not getting better. And it just can really muddy the water a lot. So I try to stay away from putting a lot of faith into those tests and then just truly look at what the cat is eating on a regular basis when it's having these flares. And then we will put the cat on a completely new and different protein that they've never been exposed to before. So reading labels is important. Doing either a home-cooked diet or a prescription diet is key because there's a lot of cross-contaminant ingredients in over-the-counter foods. Not that they're things that are bad, but in an animal that's very hypersensitive, even a small amount of chicken or beef, these cross-reactive proteins, if they can get into that over-the-counter food, that could potentially ruin a diagnostic diet trial.
So before we get really deeply into allergic disease diet versus inhalant allergies, I want to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsors and then be right back. We'll be right back. Hey there, cat lovers. It's Dr. Catherine Prim from 9 Lives with Dr. Cat. We all want our cats to be happy and healthy. Well, Meow Greens is a product that you can add to your cat's food. It improves joint health, may even reduce cancer risk. It has enzymes and probiotics and vitamins specially formulated for cats. So they have a 90-day challenge. At 30 days, you're going to see more energy and a shiny coat. By day 60, your cat's going to have a stronger immune system and improved joint health. And at day 90, better digestion, reduced inflammation, improved heart health, and you may even reduce their cancer risk. Plus, you can get a free Jumpstart trial bag for your cat today. Go to roughgreens.com and use the promo code 9lives. That's ruffgreens.com with the promo code 9lives. You don't have to change your cat's food to improve your cat's health. Just add a scoop of Meow Greens.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to 9 Lives with Dr. Cat. Dr. Joy and I are talking about skin, cat's skin, and how it isn't an easy button. Sometimes it can be a little bit of a challenge. She mentioned that diet can play a role, but may not be as important as some of the other things, and so you can't substitute diagnostics. Dr. Joy, can you talk about maybe what some of the diagnostics might be? You mentioned biopsy, but I know that you do a lot more than that.
Yes. And biopsy really is reserved for some of the cases that are a little more unusual, lesions that may not be responding to anti-inflammatory therapies. Maybe you have done a prescription diet trial and the lesions aren't going away, or, you know, you've ruled out all of the things. So when I have a cat that comes in, we should focus on maybe a certain presentation. So a cat comes in with an eosinophilic plaque. These are, thickened erosive lesions that typically are on the ventrum of the cat, but they can be in other locations. But if you have one of those lesions, a lot of times they are very moist and exudative. So I will start with cytology at that first visit. I think that we often forget that cats can have secondary infections. I think that they're underdiagnosed at times. So doing that cytology is really important. Just would not get better. The cat was also a little bit stressed when he came into the clinic. And so it was hard to really do a lot of the simple diagnostics that we usually do in-house because you almost couldn't touch him. So we got to a point where we were able to make his vet visits a little bit more comfortable for him. And we're able to get some samples. And this cat's skin was covered in yeast. And we don't often think about yeast with skin disease in cats. So I treated the secondary infections that were present, the bacteria and the yeast, and this cat has done phenomenal. But I think up until him being able to come in to see me, I don't think cytologies were possible just because he would get uber stressed when he would come into the clinic and was hard to handle. But that was really a key in getting his allergic disease more maintainable, was starting with that cytology, those simple things, and making sure that we weren't missing secondary infection, because that will definitely complicate allergic symptoms.
That is great advice. So sometimes in my exam room, I hear clients say, well, yeah, her hair's missing there on her leg, but we think it's just stress. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yes. The crazy cat idea. I'm not really sure where that came from. I think it's kind of interesting because, this could get me into a whole different conversation, but cats are often feminized. And if we remember back in like the early 1900s, there was like feminine hysteria, and women, when they would complain of certain medical symptoms, they were told they were crazy. So I don't know if that's where this like crazy cat idea or stress cat idea has come from when it's related to skin disease and other medical problems, but I find it kind of an interesting thought. But often, you know, cats do have a lot of stress, and they have a lot of things that, you know, behaviors and things that they'll do when they are stressed. But in general, if the itching and hair pulling is more generalized, it's less likely to be a behavioral or stress-related concern. But I always just sit and we spend some time talking about it. You know, I want to know about this cat's behavior in general. Is it a cat that's hiding, that has a lot of anxiety? Is there any inappropriate urination? When did these symptoms of hair pulling start? Is there a possibility that, you know, there's been a big change in the household, a new pet, a pet that's no longer there, you know, those kinds of things. We just talk about it. And a lot of times these are not stressed cats. They're cats that are happy, otherwise healthy, but they've started to pull their hair. You could always do an anti-anxiety trial. I know sometimes people use different calming medications or something like fluoxetine. You know, the other question is, have steroids been tried? If steroids have been tried and the cat regrows hair, it's a lot less likely to be a behavioral condition. But there are some papers and studies that have been done that have looked at causes for hair pulling and pruritus in cats and whether or not it's a psychogenic cause. And it's usually, most of the papers, somewhere around 14 to 20% of cases are due to more of a mental health issue as opposed to actually a medical concern. So it's a lot less likely, much more likely that it's going to be an actual allergic process or some other medical issue that's causing the hair pulling and pruritus.
So you pulled misogyny in. This show is so interesting because I was going to say it's just lazy veterinarians. That I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I'm a cat person, and I just want, sometimes I just think about that. I'm like, where did this crazy cat idea come from? I just don't know. But I think, you know, if you're in doubt, you could always, you know, do a trial of an anti-anxiety protocol, see if the cat seems more at peace and regrows hair. But in general, the majority of the cases that I see are allergic in nature.
So I see them before you see them, because I'm a general practitioner. And my first thing, and Mark and I were just talking about it before the show, my first thing is make sure there are no fleas. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yes, very important. So the three main reasons why a cat would be itchy: hair pull, overgroom, or have these recurrent lesions on their skin would be flea allergy, food hypersensitivity, or environmental allergies. So those are the top three. So I'm always delving into the ectoparasite control and the history and the use of that. So sad to say, but a lot of pet parents that have indoor only cats may become a little bit lax with their monthly flea control. I'm one of those people, so that's why I feel like I can say that. I don't routinely put flea control on my cats. I forget. I maybe don't think it's as important. You know, there's a whole host of reasons why I'm not consistent and a little bit too busy, you know, those kinds of things. And I think my pet parents, that often happens for them as well. If they have many cats, it can be very expensive to treat everyone. So we really talk about those things. And I say, hey, listen, even if this isn't flea allergy and your cats do not have, you know, nobody has fleas, you're not seeing any evidence of that in your home, you know, it's probably less likely in an indoor cat colony. However, I want to remove any possibility. You know, I don't want to come back later and have missed that this is a simple flea allergy, because we could treat that very easily when some of the other causes for allergic disease in cats are more challenging to treat. So I try to just get everybody to get on good, consistent flea control. If we can use an isoxazoline, I would prefer that, because then I can also rule out some mites that can cause itching in cats, specifically Demodex gatois. And then we can just table that concern for any ectoparasite causing nephritis. So I try to just get them on it in the beginning consistently, and then we don't have to worry about having missed that later.
That's what I say too. So I'm glad we have a unified message.
I mean, but Kat, don't you think sometimes you have it's hard to get the buy-in on that? I mean, I really, yeah. You know, totally understand that. And I just say, hey, listen, I don't want to mess up for you and go forward with all of these expensive treatments and diagnostics when it could be this. And because cats are such good groomers, you may never see the flea on a cat that's flea allergic. So it's really important just to rule it out. And once they consistently do that, the other thing is, even if your cat's primary problem isn't fleas, a lot of environmentally allergic cats will be sensitive to flea bites. So it's just removing a complicator to their allergy management. So that's another way to kind of get people to understand and hopefully be consistent with their flea preventative.
Well, it's certainly better to spend, you know, less than $200 for several months of flea control than $1,200. I mean, you know, it just makes sense. So, okay. So you talked about, though, diagnosing environmental allergens and allergies. How do you do that for cats?
So environmental allergies, and it's funny because in dogs, we call this disease atopy. In cats, the term, preferred term right now is feline atopic skin syndrome. And it's called a syndrome because it presents in a lot of different ways. And sometimes we can't identify IgE specific allergens. And it's probably a little bit of a different disease process. And that's likely also why some of the treatments that we have that are used in the canine patient are not usable or not effective in cats. And for this allergic skin syndrome or atopic skin syndrome, it is a diagnosis of exclusion. So you're not going to do an allergy test to diagnose it. You still need to rule out fleas, still rule out food in a non-seasonally itchy cat. And then once you've done that, then we can say, okay, well, this is the most likely diagnosis. And from there, allergy testing, we use that, whether it's serum testing, serum IgE testing, or intradermal testing, we use that to identify the allergens so that we can create immunotherapy. Because there's really no way to avoid all of the allergens that a cat is reactive to. Like, they can't live in a plastic bubble. So instead, I use the allergy testing to identify what I'm going to include in my immunotherapy so that I can start a desensitization protocol. So that's my goals. I think sometimes people think the test is the diagnostic test, when in fact, it's really just used as a therapeutic measure so that we can actually get them on immunotherapy.
So can you just briefly describe what the immunotherapy protocol might look like for my listeners?
Yes. Immunotherapy is actually my favorite way to treat cats with allergic disease related to environmental allergies, because it's really the only thing that I have to desensitize them, to reduce the allergic flare, and hopefully prevent them from having to stay on chronic meds. Because in cats, unfortunately, we really only have one licensed treatment, and that's Atopica or now Modulus, which is available. But both of those are essentially forms of modified cyclosporin. Steroids are also used. And of course, we all know, you know, those come with a host of side effects. So the immunotherapy really is my favorite thing to do. And it's just like in people, you get allergy tested and you start allergy shots. That's the most traditional form. And so over time, you're getting introduced to small amounts of the allergens you're reactive to so that your body mounts an immune response and becomes desensitized. And then there's kind of this shift in the inflammatory proportion of cells in the body, and it becomes less reactive over time is the goal of the immunotherapy. Shots can be challenging in some cats to do at home. And so we have sublingual immunotherapy. They're also called allergy drops that can be given under the tongue or absorbed along the cheek. And then the third form that we've started using is transdermal immunotherapy. And I've been doing that for about 2 years now and have seen some really great success with that. And cats tolerate that so well. So I really love that form and really just trying to discuss with a pet parent what is going to be doable for them and able to be maintained through the treatment protocol.
Excellent. That is really, really helpful. So before we wrap up, I want you to boil it down. What is one thing that you wish every cat owner knew about keeping their cat's skin healthy?
Yeah. So I think one of the things is that, you know, I think that we accept a lot of things in our cats because they don't complain so much. You know, like cats just, they're just, you know, like you may not notice that the cat is naked until they're really bald and naked. Like you may not notice the over-grooming. And there are cats that over-groom in private, like the pet parents don't really see them pulling their hair out. So just, you know, being aware of the quality of their skin, if you're seeing bald patches, if your cat is, you know, scratching or chewing at themselves, some cats will do that. If there's any lesions on the skin, really getting them care early on, I think, is really important. One, so that we can figure out, you know, what the true diagnosis is. But two, you know, if you do have an allergic cat, getting them on immunotherapy early is going to be the best thing to maintaining their skin the best. Because until we get more medications, you know, that's the best way to avoid chronic steroids, in my opinion.
So look under your cat, too.
Pick them up and look under the cat. So that's, I always call it, it's kind of funny, but I call it the no pants cat. You know, the top line looks perfect. The hips, the tail base look perfect. And then you pick the cat up and the entire belly is naked. So the no pants cat can often hide from you.
I like it. I've never called it the no pants cat.
Yeah, it's like party in the back, business in the front, or vice versa.
Well, it's been so fun to talk to you and such an informative conversation. I think my listeners can get a lot from what we talked about today. Is there anywhere that my listeners would be able to find out a little bit more about you or maybe veterinary dermatologists in general?
Sure. I have an Instagram page, Dr. Joya, the Pet Skin Vet. I also have a Facebook, Dr. Joya Griffin DVM. And then I also have a website. So there's lots of ways to find me, which Catherine can provide those for you. And, you know, Animal Dermatology Clinic is the company that I have worked for the past 15 years. Absolutely love being with them. And we have clinics all over the country. If your pet is in need of care, you can go on that website and find a dermatologist near you.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners for taking time out of their day to learn a little bit more about how to keep their cat's skin healthy. As always, thanks to my meowsing producer, Mark Winter. And remember that healthy skin is happy skin. If you like what you heard on our show, please subscribe, follow, and share, and go out and have a perfect day.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.